is nowhere to rest your eye that does not behold the face of the beloved. There is nothing here but you and God, and no real harm can ever be done to either. So what is there to forgive? It's so hard to keep this perspective, to remember the truth when things get crazy and we fear the worst. All I can do is go back to my breath and remember that the Holy Spirit is what fills me with every inhale. How could it be otherwise? When we get it, all this anguish seems so unnecessary. When we lose it, suffering seems to be the only option. This excerpt is from Oriah Mountain Dreamer's latest book, The Call, published by Harper San Francisco and available everywhere. It seems to echo what many of us are feeling these days, especially with our world in so much chaos. Like her previous books, The Invitation and The Dance, on which our last interview was based, Oriah offers her own life experience as validation that we're not alone in our craziness nor in our search for authenticity in our lives. Welcome to Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson. And I'd like to welcome Oriah Mountain Dreamer to our show today.
Thank you.
Oriah, can you talk a little bit about how you were indeed called through writing this book and how that's changed the way you formerly led your life?
Well, I think on some level, you know, we're continually being called to really live the meaning at the center of our lives. I think there are moments that are more acute than others. And for some of us, that call, you know, is, well, for all of us, the call is shaped by our personality, who we are, and what we're likely to listen to. And for me, it's often this kind of sense of wanting to live from a deeper place and really wanting to find a way of ease, knowing that when I'm struggling with the world in my life, that something is off, and yet feeling often like I can't find a way out of that into a place of greater ease.
Right. Now, you talk about quite a few things that I've read over and over in like Buddhist thought. I'm sure there's no coincidence where, you know, thousands of years of something that's come to pass has brought people to the realization that suffering and surrender and lack of attachment, impermanence, these kinds of things. What surrender is not in your book is what I found interesting, what you say surrender is not. If I can grab that, or if you remember what your thought was on that.
Well, what I don't remember exactly. What I do remember is that for years, you know, I've said to myself, or other people have said to me, you know, you just have to let go of that. And wanting to surrender, and feeling like that must be some kind of action that was eluding me, you know.
Yeah.
Knowing
yeah.
I wanted to do it, but not knowing how to do it, and that it really is more a not doing than a doing. It's more of a being able to be with what is. And one of the things I discovered through a whole experience of listening to some music and whatnot is that the phrase "let it be" is more helpful to me than "let it go," because letting go is really about being with things the way they are. I mean, in other words, it's letting go of our desire to make them instantly different. And I'm not arguing here against taking action that will make the world a safer, kinder place, but that kind of drivenness where we want it to be other than it is in this moment, which is not a great place to start from, and it's not a sustainable place to start from. So surrender starts, I think, really with letting what is inside ourselves and around us be what it is in the moment and really being with that, which sometimes can be very difficult to do.
Right. Yeah, I found the place in the book you're talking about, collapsing physically and emotionally is not surrendering. In other words, yes, surrendering needs to be a conscious choice. It isn't surrendering because everything has fallen down around your ears.
Yeah, collapsing and exhaustion. I mean, if that was surrender, I'd be the all-time expert at it, you know. But in just sort of realizing that driving myself to the place of that tiredness and then collapsing and calling it surrender is not really surrender. It's my way of continuing the war with what is. And so, you know, I collapse and I regroup and I get my energy back and I go back out there and go at it again. That's not surrender.
Well, it's a great Western way, don't you think? I mean, people do push until something happens that prevents them from pushing anymore, whether it's illness or, you know, a breakdown mentally or whatever.
Yeah.
Too bad we have to, you know, take it to that point.
Well, and I mean, that's one of the things that makes it so difficult to slow down and let our movement come from a very still center, is that we are surrounded by the voices internally and externally of a culture that says, move, 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 do, you know. I was coming home a couple of weeks ago on a plane, and a man ahead of me had a copy of the financial page of USA Today open, and the banner read, "I do, therefore I am." And I thought, right, that would be the kind of slogan of our culture.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So stopping is a challenge. And I'm not talking here about stopping and not doing anything, never moving. I'm talking about just stopping long enough to go into the still center and letting your actions really flow from that place.
Yeah, I was reading somewhere the other day something about stopping at that place doesn't necessarily discard all thought. You know, it doesn't
right.
mean that you're going to be brain dead, that nothing's going to occur to you, but that those thoughts will be more conscious.
Yes. And I think you also begin to recognize the color of certain thoughts. You know, when you sit in stillness, you hear the thoughts that have the voice of fear. And so you're not driven by them. You notice them. I mean, it's also, I think, you give them their due in the sense that they come from perhaps a reason why you're fearful inside. But it's less about running out into the world unconsciously.
Right.
So it's making some of those thoughts much more conscious and understanding where they're coming from within myself.
Right. You mentioned the one word in your book that we've been hearing all our life, hypothetically, and how often in your presentations others actually become irritated because you don't tell them what they're... Sorry, I can't help but laugh at that, because you don't tell them what their word is.
That's right. It's been kind of funny, really, because there's a segment of the poem, The Call, that says there is one word you are here to say with your whole being.
Right.
When it finds you, give your life to it. And a number of people, when I first put it out, wrote me back and said, so what's my word? And I think they thought it was some sort of nasty little marketing ploy to get them to buy the book,
yeah.
You know. You can't find it out unless you buy the book. But I say very clearly, I don't know your word. And I also say, you know, that I'm not positing this as, you know, a God-given, this is the way it is. It's a way of thinking of the purpose of my life, particularly for myself, who tends to think I need to do it all, to kind of narrow that down to human size. What if I was here just to say one thing, and if I did that with all of my being, it would be held in a way in the collective dream that would really ripple out from me. What would that one thing be? Then I suggest that instead of going to, you know, the lovely things that we all want to have in the collective peace and love and truth, I suggest that those are essence words and that ours are smaller words. And that that your one word is best found by looking at what you struggle with, what you long for, but you find elusive. That often seems to you to be come with great ease to the people who are around you. The reason I suggest this is I'm not suggesting we have to suffer to make a contribution, and many of the things that come easily to us that are great gifts we share with our communities, and they're part of what we offer. But what I am suggesting is that the thing that we struggle with, that we long for and struggle with, is the thing that we have to do consciously. We cannot unconsciously do it because it doesn't come easily to us. We have to learn how to do it. And even if we only get a little piece of it, we then hold that word with a whole other level of awareness. For me, the word is rest, and I will never find myself unconsciously resting. It's not going to happen.
Yep.
Not my personality. So what I've learned about rest, although it may not be a great deal, has been hard won in a sense and has been very conscious. So if I'm talking to somebody who has difficulty resting, I might be able to actually share some things with them about what I've learned about rest. Conversely, you know, if somebody asked me, and someone did recently, about how I discipline myself to do the work I know I need to do, and I said to them, you know, I'm not going to be very much help to you, because for whatever reason, with my story and personality, discipline comes fairly easily to me. Rest does not. So in other words, I'm more valuable to somebody who's struggling with rest than I am with somebody who's struggling with discipline. I'm likely to just say something fairly ineffective like, well, you just do what you have to do. And for somebody who's struggling with self-discipline, that's not really helpful.
Yeah, I like the story that you gave about the talented body worker kind of healer that you knew. I do a similar kind of technique, and people have asked me over the years if I would teach that. And I've always been frustrated with that because it's a gift. I was born with vision. I was born with this touch. And
yeah.
So it's really difficult to teach something
yeah.
that, and it really clarified that for me. Yeah, that's why I can't teach it. I didn't learn it step by step.
Yeah.
Perhaps I can teach it, but my integrity says I would not be the best teacher.
Right, and you'd have to go back. You know, I did this once. Somebody asked me to teach a class on what out-of-body experiences were like, which was something that came to me since I was a young child.
Yeah.
I literally had to go buy a book.
I've done that too.
Because I couldn't break it down into any kind of steps or methods, or, I mean, it was something that just came very easily to me.
Right.
So, I mean, we really are, I think, more valuable teachers of the things that we've had to consciously learn step by step than the things, you know, that come to us easily, which of course are part of the gifts we offer the world. But in terms of actual teaching, I think it's the things we struggle with that we really offer.
I definitely agree, because like you, I went out and bought a book on how to teach what I do, and it's like I would not be the best teacher. Let someone teach it who's better.
Yeah.
So that was definitely a help to get that clarified. I also just want to say I love your writing. I love it because it's so personal. The way that you write really just reflects your personal experience, and you don't make claims about, you know, having the corner on truth. So I think it's very readable, and I really have recommended this book to so many people already who've been deeply touched by it. So thank you. Again, we are speaking on Alternative Currents today with Oriah Mountain Dreamer, author of The Call, published by Harper's San Francisco. When you mention your word is rest, mine is definitely gentleness, because, and one thing I was trying to get to that word, and I thought, well, I'm gentle with everyone else. I teach clients to be gentle with themselves, but I have a really hard time to be gentle with myself. So I wonder if often we find ourselves teaching or immersed in something that has something to do with our word, and we're giving it away, but we don't necessarily listen to that, you know.
Absolutely. Although, you know, there can be, I mean, as you teach clients to be gentle with themselves, you learn what you need to teach, or you teach what you need to learn.
Oh, exactly.
So you're clear now. I mean, the next step, of course, is listening to those same words and applying them to yourself, which is another whole step. But I certainly found that teaching has really helped me begin to get a handle on some of the things that I personally struggle with. And I'm very open with that. It's not like I pretend to be the expert at
it. Exactly.
And I think people want to hear from somebody who is struggling with it themselves, you know?
Yeah.
When people who find resting and relaxation really easy tell me to relax, not only is it not helpful to me, I don't really want to hear from them.
Yeah.
I want to hear from somebody who finds it difficult to rest and hear what they might have to tell me, and they're not likely just to say to me, oh, relax, because they know that's not useful.
No. No. I have a similar reaction to that. Those kind of people. I've been contemplating kind of, you know, where this all began with this gentleness business, and a lot of it began with parents and others' expectations of me as a child, but also from a strongly patriarchal religious background. So I really love that you quoted Meister Eckhart. How long will grown men and women in this world keep drawing in their coloring books an image of God that makes them sad? And also, it is a lie, any talk of God that does not comfort you, because I certainly discovered this when tracing my anger back to God and feeling abandoned by this force, in a sense. You know, kind of screaming at the heavens and realizing all I was getting back from this source was love and gentle guidance. It just was not the God I expected from my youth, and reminds me, in a way, of your story about the voices when you were a child.
Yeah. Yes, I mean that, you know, and so many, I love those Meister Eckhart quotes because, you know, he had this sort of direct experience of spirit, and I think anyone who does, I've never heard yet of anyone having a direct experience of kind of a chastising, cruel God,
never.
You know,
yeah.
And yet so many of us were raised with, if not that severe, at least the kind of sense of, you know, God can see whatever you do and is judging it, kind of. And the terror, and it's kind of, well, I better get in there and judge myself first to make sure I get myself cleaned up here, you know, that breeds, doesn't really foster any kind of self-love.
Right. Yeah, I like the saying that we humans make God in our own image rather than God created humans. And
that's kind of scary at times, isn't it?
It is. Can you tell about the voices a little bit, how that... Your story about that?
About hearing...
When you heard the voices when you were little, yeah.
Yeah, you know, when I was young, from the time earliest time I can remember, I heard answers to my prayers. And I don't mean answers like, this is what you need to do. I would hear most often questions. And I thought everybody did, which was kind of interesting. I just thought we didn't talk about it because we don't talk about breathing either, you know. And I was actually 14 before I found out that not everyone did. I also had, are you referring to the story in the call about the voices that weren't too pleasant?
Yeah.
This is a very strange story and one that I haven't actually told very much because I think it's very odd. But when I was very, very young, I remember, I'm under 5 years old, having a sense of voices and a presence that came to me when I would be upset about something in my life. And there was nothing horrible happening in my life, but, you know, the normal kind of child upsets, who said to me that if I went with them, everything would be okay. And they had this kind of sickly sweetness to them. And I knew intuitively that they were bad voices. Now, I have to say I was raised in a Protestant tradition where I never heard Satan or the devil or anything like this mentioned at all. So I had no concept of that. I didn't label it. I just knew these were bad. And I prayed. And I'd always had this sense of a presence of God, of Christ, of something larger than myself. And that presence was right there when I prayed. But, and this is the kind of strangest part, I knew that that presence, that God, could not help me with these voices that were saying, come with us, it'll be fine, until I decided what I was going to do. And I tell in the book how I this was a very vivid experience that happened for at least 3 nights when I was a very young child, and I forgot about it for years until I was in my 20s, and it sort of came back to me. And what shocked me most was the idea that, and seemed unfair to me, was the idea that at 4 or 5 years old, I had felt the truth of how responsible I was, how much free will I had to make this choice. And it seemed to me like that was crazy, that a child. But I knew and did not feel incapable of making that choice,
right,
and would tell those voices to go away. I mean, I need to say here that it wasn't that I thought I was going to physically go anywhere with these voices. There was a sense that they would give me some comfort, but by taking the comfort, I would be inviting them into my life, into my psyche, on an ongoing basis. I would be opening a door to something that was not good at all. So I told the voices each night, the 3 nights, to go away, and then I would have this image of resting, really, in the hand of God. So it was a very vivid experience, and I had an incredible sense during it that it wasn't that God didn't care which way I decided, but that God could not intervene, that I had free will, and the minute I decided that I was then held in this hand that really comforted and was with me. But I had to make that choice. I had to decide. And that really embedded in me, I think, well beyond belief, a sense that we have free will choice, that it really is up to us to how we respond to what passes through our lives, what tempts us that may not be good for us or for our communities, that it really is a choice that we have.
Yeah. Yeah. And how that relates to suffering was interesting also. Referring to the book again, suffering is not created, it's allowed.
Yeah.
You have free will.
Well, because I think there are times when I, and probably most people, look at the news and in our own lives, but we see some of the horrendous things that human beings do to each other. And in those moments, I'm tempted to think, let's forget about the free will thing. You know, when I hear about a child being abused, I don't care about free will. I just want it to stop. But the fact is that having free will is indicative of this incredible love, that whatever you think of the creative life forces being, God, the Great Mother, Allah, whatever you think of it as being, gives us, creates within us this free will. And it's an incredible act of love to do that with beings that, quite frankly, are capable of doing some pretty horrendous things to each other and causing suffering. So that suffering is allowed because the only way to give us free will is it has to be truly free, that we can, in fact, take actions that create suffering.
And also that ripples out to that same group that we're part of, no matter whether it's the dark elements or the shadow elements or whether it's the more conscious elements. I mean, I think if we can see that wholeness of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, that we know our actions are not so small, that arc.
You know, it's a kind of paradox, isn't it? That on the one hand, we get a sense of this immense wholeness, that we're a tiny little piece of. And we do get a little overblown at times thinking how important we are. On the other hand, because it is this wholeness, how we are ripples out from us and affects the whole all the time. So, you know, it's a strange kind of paradox to hold with humility both your sense of your smallness and also a sense that how you do whatever you do, how you are with others, how you are with yourself, ripples out from you. And we know this from meeting at times people who have perhaps a more consistent consciousness of this. I've heard stories of people meeting the Dalai Lama or Mother Teresa and feeling in themselves a kind of awakening that gets set up just in proximity with someone who's awake.
Right.
And that's the wonderful half of it, you know, that can ripple out. There's a great story in the book. A friend of mine, Mickey Lemley, made the movie Fierce Compassion about Ram Dass. And in the movie, Larry Brilliant, one of the co-founders of the Siva Foundation, talks about sitting with Maharishi, Ram Dass's guru in India, and he says, it didn't surprise me that when I sat with Maharishi, I felt how much he loved everyone. He was a saint. You know, he's an enlightened being. That's his job. He says, what surprised me is when I sat with Maharishi, I felt how much I loved everyone. Now, he didn't get that. It wasn't that he was getting Maharishi's love for everyone. What happened was because that was so strong in that particular teacher, it awakened in him that same essential nature that has this incredible love. So we have enormous power, even though we are, you know, tiny in the wholeness, to really, if we do it consciously or unconsciously, we have enormous power to set up this kind of ripple effect in the world. And we do all the time, often unconsciously, of course.
Right. I also know you're a fan of Rumi's. I can tell from your writing. I love this particular poem of his. The early breeze before dawn is the keeper of secrets. Don't go back to sleep. It is time for prayer. It is time to ask for what you really need. Don't go back to sleep. The door of the one who created the world is always open. Don't go back to sleep. Why do you feel it is so hard to stay awake?
Well, I think because there are things in the reality that we pull away from because they hurt and we're afraid we won't be able to bear it. The big one being constant state of impermanence. So I think one of the reasons we go to sleep is because we find it hard to be with how everything is impermanent, that in this lifetime, everyone, every situation, every place, every activity that we love will change and pass. That's what is constant. And I think that's a difficult reality, not an impossible reality, but it's a difficult reality to just be with. And as long as we don't try to consciously be with it, what we unconsciously do is we try to move away from it. And the only way to do that is to go to sleep. I mean, that's the reality we have. So the only way to move away from that sense of loss that is sometimes hard for us is to find some way of going to sleep. And, you know, there's 1,000 ways to do that, to kind of numb out and go to sleep in our culture in particular. But human beings are very creative. We can do that, you know, all over the place. So I think in order to be awake, the first thing we have to do is we have to look at how we fight with what is and then develop a practice that will let us just simply be with what is without feeling that the pain will kill us. And, you know, in all fairness, there are times when loss, I've talked to people who've lost a child, will go through a period where they really feel like it will kill them. And, you know, with an enormous amount of support and various ways that people find to give comfort, many of those people do continue even more awake, even though that reality is so hard to be with. So I think, you know, essentially we go to sleep because we're not happy about some of the things in the nature of reality, impermanence being one of them, interdependence being another one. You know, this whole illusion of I can keep my family safe or my country, or, you know, this wanting to separate from the whole for some safety. And in fact, of course, the nature of reality is we are all interdependent with each other. No possible way to remove ourselves from this. So I think these are just some of the things that we fight with. I mean, lastly, what I'd say is that mostly we're not happy with ourselves. I think many of us have given up or, and with great consciousness, feel we have surrendered material values. You know, we're not necessarily wanting to be rich and famous and make a lot of money or all that kind of thing, but we've replaced it with spiritual ambition, where we want to be fully enlightened, and we're not happy with the self that's not fully enlightened. So again, we go to sleep because we don't like to be with what is, because sometimes what is not particularly pleasant or pretty.
Yeah. I think it's a good time to take a break, and we'll be back after a station identification. You are listening to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 in Bangor. This is Alternative Currents with Bella Johnson and Oriah Mountain Dreamer, and we'll be back in a couple minutes. From Marilyn Strong's song for Sophia. And we're back with Oriah Mountain Dreamer, Alternative Currents, heard on WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill, 102.9 Bangor. Oriah, impermanence. Also, I like the way you related to this as a parent, your statement that if you were doing it right, then it being parenting and letting your sons go, you would somehow not feel grief.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, being with impermanence doesn't mean we just go, oh, yeah, well, there it is, another change, you know. We love, and to be fully human is to love deeply. And that means that there are times when we are going to feel lost when change happens, even when it's change that we want to have happen. And I related this to my two sons, who are now 20 and 23 and off at university, and there's been an enormous shift in my life from a household which largely shaped around the needs of two sons, and the feedback and, you know, both good and bad from two sons, and now living alone with my husband and feeling the loss of that. And this is a change that I chose, that I want for them as well as for myself, and yet still there's a loss there. It's not, you know, an incapacitating, crushing grief. But it took me a while to figure out that what I was feeling was the loss, and just to give that its due and to be with it. The other thing, you know, Suzuki Roshi said, we don't need to learn to let go. We just need to learn to recognize when something is already gone. And what I'm realizing in my life is it takes time sometimes for us to recognize when something is gone. I had a dear friend die this summer, and she and I shared a birthday in September, and I kept waiting unconsciously, semi-consciously on the day of our birthday for her to phone me. And I kept having to think, no, Mary Claire's gone. So, you know, it's partly giving ourselves our due, giving ourselves, recognizing that as human beings, it takes us a while sometimes to really recognize when something is gone, and that there's a kind of ache with that. It doesn't need to be, again, an excruciating, crushing kind of thing, but to acknowledge the loss and the grief. Annie Lamott said something about the only way through grief is by grieving. And fortunately or unfortunately, that's what is. There's no way around it. You know, you feel the grief. And grief is kind of a process of that realizing that something is gone. Even if it's gone because of a choice that we made and there are good things about it, there's still a loss there.
I also don't think we can really feel joy, you know, unless we can feel that grief. I mean, I don't think we can go to the, so to speak, the heights unless we can go to the depths, do you?
Same nerve ending, so you can't.
Yeah. I mean, I had the same kind of experience. My daughter, whom you recently met on one of your tours, was the first to leave home. And I remember going in her room every day and just, it seemed for about 3 months, I'd cry almost every day because my first child had left home. When the second left, it was a lot easier.
Yeah.
But I really, you know, I knew I had to do it. I knew I had to really honor that.
Yeah.
And nothing in Western culture really encourages us to grieve.
No, and I think, in fact, many of those kinds of changes, particularly the one you're talking about where children, you know, grow up and leave home, because women have often been the primary caregivers, it's like it happens in a whole invisible world. It just the very same way women with very small children at home are happening in what in the culture is largely an invisible world, not really talked about, acknowledged, and whatnot. You know, one of the strange things when your children leave home is that for whatever, 18, 20 years, some piece of you has been constantly involved in the care of these people, even if it's just in the back of your mind what time they're coming home, whether they have work tonight, you know, whatever. And all of a sudden that stops. Now, it's not like there isn't ongoing support going on for children who have left home, but the nature of that kind of moment-to-moment daily thing with that intimate connection with a group of people living together is gone. And it feels very odd, really. Mm. I mean, you kind of wonder what happened.
Yeah,
even though you knew it was going to happen.
And really wanted it like you did. You know,
yeah.
Really always fostered independence in
absolutely.
My daughters. You know, but it was odd how much it hit me.
Really. So, you know, is it any wonder then that we feel incredible loss when it's something that we didn't want to have happen?
Yeah.
You know, someone dies, particularly someone dying young, or, you know, loss of career that's been barreling along and all the attendant terror about how one will make a living, whatever those things are, you know. So if we just start with the little ones, and I mean, I think with all of this, we need to start, it's like picking up 5-pound weights before you pick up the 50-pound weights, you know, and just to be with the sense of loss when it is something that you wanted, that is essentially good, and yet there's still a sense of change and loss, and to sort of practice just being with that. Because I don't think there's much chance we're going to be able to be with the big ones that are much harder if we can't be with the ones that are, you know, essentially good change, but nevertheless change that sometimes is hard.
Yeah. Well, and that feeds into the lack of attachment as well. I love your statement that lack of attachment to having things work out the way we want them to is not the same thing as the indifference that comes from not fully committing to a human life.
And I find a lot of confusion about that in different spiritual groups. You know, where people, I think, with all sincerity, wanting to cultivate that lack of attachment so that they're not operating out of fear, go to a place of this kind of strange, cold detachment. And, of course, that's not what it is. It's about keeping your heart open and loving continually and then letting go when the time is there to let go, and particularly letting go of those kinds of the way we want the results to come out. There's a wonderful little piece at the end of one of Mary Oliver's poems that's in the book called The Blackwater Woods, where she says, to live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones knowing your own life depends upon it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. So she's not talking about, you know, living without, you know, really loving and holding close to you. When it's appropriate, what you love and who you love. But then the other piece of it is being able to let go.
Mm-hmm. Well, take a little turn here. So much is said about Jung's Konjunkto, or the sacred marriage. I really, though, like your idea of the marriage of ego and essence. It really does seem to me to be a form of sacred marriage. Can you speak to this a little bit?
You know, I talk in the beginning of the book about going on a vision quest, and that what I realized in hindsight, that what I was really hoping for was a personality transplant. I wanted to spiritually or surgically have my particular personality removed and to be given at least in what I would think of as an easier one, one that might, that I imagined would be easier to live a spiritual life if I was less outspoken, less fiery, less something. Now, of course, this isn't going to work. Wanting a personality transplant is like wanting to wake up 3 inches taller in the morning, which at my age is not going to happen. So I sat for a long time with my desire to get rid of the ego, get rid of the kind of individuated self that has a particular story and strengths and weaknesses and propensities, and how attractive at times that has seemed to me, particularly when I've had a strong experience of what I would say is my essence, of the kind of stuff that we're all made of, which is this kind of deep, still presence and center, and wanting to be that and just that. And, you know, over and that in itself being a sort of a great cause for suffering, because the truth is, as a human being, I can't be one or the other. I mean, the stuff I'm made of is essence, whether I'm aware of it or not, and what I want is to be awake to that's what I am. But at the same time, the shape that that essence takes in the life of Orion Mountain Dreamer is a very particular woman with very particular thoughts and feelings and sensations that are always moving and changing but form a kind of story. And it doesn't mean that I'm prey to always being driven by that if I have a certain level of what I would call ego awareness. So I'm aware of what my strengths and weaknesses are, where the things are that trigger my fear, my despair, my happiness. And, you know, watching those, but allowing myself to be fully human, to be this marriage of ego awareness and essence awareness. In other words, being awake to both what I am and who I am, and living that fully. That's a very different thing than trying to sort of leave behind the personality, the person, the individuated self, which, in essence, I don't think there's a spiritual path that actually advocates that. It's just something that happens when human beings, you know, begin to aspire to be better than we are. We want to leave behind who we are. I love Ram Dass's story years ago, you know, about after years and years of doing spiritual practice, he hadn't gotten rid of a single neurosis. He just recognized them a lot sooner and went, you know, okay, there you are, come on in.
Yeah.
And I think there's some need for a kind of radical self-acceptance if we're going to be truly human, if we're going to be able to be with what is, which includes what we are.
Yeah, I'll often, you know, pat myself on the arm, just kind of unconsciously, just rub my arm and say, it's okay, honey, it's all right.
Yeah.
You know, really,
yeah.
Because no one else did that for, you know, the whole time I was growing up. So I think it's really important to come to that kind of acceptance that you are who you are, you know.
Yeah.
You have got that, and that's okay, you know.
Yeah, and that it doesn't mean that you use that as an excuse to kind of do things, continue patterns that may be destructive to yourself or others.
Sure.
But you also look at, you know, what that is about me, what it is about me that, you know, for me it's just kind of often getting very driven, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a very light side to that, this longing to really learn what I need to learn and to do it now, you know. And, of course, there's a dark side to it, which is the kind of lack of acceptance of where I am right in the moment. So just sort of being with that more than anything, and knowing that that's probably always going to be there.
Well, like you, I spent years proving to God that I had not become complacent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that drivenness being bred of that or born of that.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, I'm on task.
Yes.
You know.
But there's some kind of strange belief underneath that, you know, that we have to earn everything.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so silly when you think about it, because we don't earn our lives. We don't earn the incredible beauty around us. It's given to us. It's a gift of grace. But some of us, somewhere along the line, whether we came in with it or we're taught it, have this kind of belief of, if I'm not working hard and earning, I don't know what will happen. The world will come to an end.
Right. I also like you saying, recognizing your own tribe, you know, those with whom you share a particular way of touching the mystery and living your essence is important. That's a quote. But really, yes, you know, acknowledging this.
Mm-hmm. And having those people in your life where you can have fun and ease with, and then making sure that you include in your life people of different tribes who teach you how to look at things differently.
Right.
You know, in your intimate life also. I mean, it's, you know, we think at some point that we're going to be with somebody who's like us, and then I think at some age we figure out that, you know, I have certain things covered. I don't really need that.
Yeah.
I know that I don't need somebody who's urging me to work more.
Me neither.
And so you begin to look, I think, at people where you complement each other more and where you broaden each other's worlds more than just, and that doesn't necessarily mean you always agree, you know. My husband is a scientist. He works in engineering. He's an astronomer. He builds telescopes. That's the way he touches the mystery. And he's also a composer, but that has those qualities for him. That is very different than the way that I do it. But we recognize in the essence of what each of us do the same longing to touch that mystery.
Yeah.
We just do it in very different ways.
Yeah, and allowing that difference, allowing the other to be other, as mm-hmm. Jung so often said, you know, just withdrawing our projections about what they should be or,
yeah.
You know, it's, I just think is a wonderful.
Well, I've just been married for 1 year. We just celebrate our first year anniversary, and, you know, the withdrawing of projections can be very painful.
Yeah.
But we're still here.
Good for you.
And we're having a good time.
Great. Fabulous. I do want to remind listeners that we are speaking on alternative currents today with Oriah Mountain Dreamer, author of The Call and also The Invitation and the Dance, published, I believe, all of them by Harper San Francisco and available everywhere. This is her latest book. Oriah, at times I think we all want to postpone our ideal life to when our real life slows down or mm-hmm. a major shift occurs. And your discovery that in the midst of relocating and all the chaos created around the move, you started to write in the midst of it all, triggered something I'd been feeling around about myself. And in the fact of just living in the moment, just being with that, not waiting for something to shift so that I can get a life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, how many people have got sort of the real life they want to live on hold until something happens, you know? And of course, we all know the stories of people retiring to begin their real life and, you know, dropping dead of a heart attack 6 months later. And the fact is, we're in our real life. You know, there's a Tibetan saying that says, if you want to stop, then stop. If you're seeking a time when you will be finished, you will never be done. And I would say if you want to, and fill in that word stop, I mean, for me it happens often to be stop, but fill that word in with whatever word of what it is you really long for, you know, and don't postpone. But I think the other piece here is it's about going to the essence of what you want to do. So somebody says to me, you know, well, I really want to go and study and do sitting meditation at a retreat center, but I have two children. I can't do that right now. And that's quite true. But what's the essence of what they're seeking in that experience is to maybe have some silence in their life or to live from a deeper place. And that they can begin to do right now where they are. So, you know, here I was ready to write this book, The Call, about going to stillness and listening to the call. And for various reasons and choices, my life had really speeded up. I just bought a house. We were trying to sell a house. We were packing up two households and moving them into one, planning a wedding. There were lawyers and real estate agents, sending two sons off to university, packing them up. And in the midst of this, I was going to write about stillness, and part of me was tempted to say, well, I'll wait until I'm moved and all that happens. And then I thought, but what good is it? What good is anything I have to say about stillness if I can't access it for a moment here and there, at least, in the midst of what is pretty normal life happening. You know, there was nothing extraordinary happening. It was all just life happening the way it always does. And, you know, the endless logistics of life, which is often what gets us more than anything, is logistics.
Absolutely. And, you know, like you, I've kind of dropped the idea of, well, I'm still trying to drop the idea of trying to mentally keep aware of everything, you know, past, present, future, everything on my mind. I think often when we do that, we're just kind of so blitzed out that we can't really be in that moment and center ourselves and find that quiet place.
Yeah. And we're just worn out. We're too tired. And I will say this, if with myself, I look at that and I think sometimes, unconsciously, I do that to wear myself out.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's a great way not to be present with what is, to go back to sleep. You're just too tired to be awake.
Right.
And it seems to be such a highly justifiable reason because you're doing all this good stuff, you know. But it's just another way of going back to sleep. Keep yourself running. Yeah. And if not physically, mentally. And, you know, I can keep the hamsters running even when I'm laying down.
Oh, you're in good company. In your first chapter, you're describing a reflective episode when you lie down exhausted and you're frustrated at learning in hindsight. And I've so many times in my life, I've felt that same frustration before I realized, as I'm sure you have, the value of making time for reflection as a means by which we do indeed learn. In fact, if we could live life in hindsight, you know,
right.
If we could write, yeah, reverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It would be more fun, I think, in a way, but probably not.
Well, and for me, that's a lot of what the writing is about. I mean, I write pretty much every day, and most of that will never be published.
Mm.
But it is a way for me to really reflect on what's going on inside me and in my life. And, I mean, I do that in other ways. I do a practice of prayer and meditation, but it's the writing for me that will really always take me to the center of what's really going on. And I think people have to find, you know, there are different ways that people do that, but they need to find a way to do that. And, of course, one of the things I find interesting is on the rare occasions when I'm not writing, I'm aware of it. Like, if I haven't written for 4 or 5 days, I think, okay, what am I avoiding?
Right.
What is it I'm not too thrilled about finding out is going on, you know, usually inside me more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, very shortly, then I'll sit down and do some writing.
One thing I wanted to touch on with you, I know you're a Canadian citizen, mm-hmm. but I'm sure you're very aware of what's going on politically in this country.
Oh, yeah.
With the war
and I've been spending a lot of time there with the book touring and things.
Yes. I like your statement, when we have put our faith in doing, where do we turn when there is simply nothing to be done that can make a difference? Can you speak a little to how a person can reconcile the ideas of non-resistance and non-resentment with what's going on right now with that political situation about kind of fighting reality and, you know,
yeah.
How do we deal with that?
And it's such a difficult line here because there may be things that people can do that will change things in the future. And how do you do that and stay in the present moment and not be attached to the outcome? So what I would say right now is when I travel in the U.S. and listen to the news, because I don't have television at home and I don't get any American media at home, what I feel more than anything is overwhelming sadness. I just feel an incredible kind of ache of the heart for what's going on. And that ache of the heart is mainly for America, not even for the places where America may be doing something that I'm not too crazy about.
Yeah.
And what I try and do, first of all, is just stay with that. And because I think that the people who, that when we get angry about what's going on, what maybe other decisions that other people are making, that underneath that is both fear, of course, and an incredible sadness. So to be able to be with that sadness and that stillness and then follow the movement that comes from that place, from being with what is, without attachment to the result. And actually, I would say that when you follow the movement that comes from that stillness of being with what is, whether that's sadness, fear, grief, anger, it's actually relatively easy to not be attached to result, because that movement comes from such a place of stillness. It's not about result. It's about, what do I need to do? How do I need to respond internally and externally? You know. So, you know, often when I'm speaking in the U.S. right now, and as we're talking about, for instance, our essential nature, being compassionate and capable of being fully present and acting from that compassion, I'll often pause and I'll say, and that's what everything is made of. So that's what George W. Bush is made of. That's what Osama bin Laden is made of.
Yeah.
You know, and you can feel everybody in the room take a breath, like, right, okay, got to stretch just a little here, right? That it's all of us. It's not, there's no them in us. It is all of us. And we're all operating out of the same essential nature. And then with our individual, you know, strengths and weaknesses and fears, which are not very different from each other's. So to somehow hold that space and let, that doesn't preclude doing action, you know, whatever kind of political action or community action that seems appropriate for you, but to do it from that space of inclusiveness, without the attachment to, and I want it to result in this. I mean, Gandhi's got to be the probably best example of that, where his constant concern was, what am I to do? What is my responsibility to hold this place? And it wasn't that he didn't have something he wanted to see happen, but each of his action had to do with, what do I do? What's the place I hold now, internally and externally? And absolute faith that as he did that, that would ripple out and the change would occur. So it's it maybe in essence it's about faith. You know, it's about faith in putting ourselves into that flow of life and really committing to that. But that may start with something as simple as, you know, my turning the news off when I'm on the road and just sitting with the sadness, just breathing into my own heart and the horrible sadness I feel for some of the choices that are being made that I think are shifting American history in a way that is not good for America. Not good for all of us, but I mean not. I mean it's not sort of a, how dare you do this to someone else? It's more, what do we do to ourselves when we do some of these things?
Yeah.
Well, something, does that make sense?
Yes. Something that you said also caught my attention. I had a great psych professor at Vermont College, and she used to say, "You have to know what your questions are." Excuse me. And for the longest time, I'd look at her with a blank stare, like, "What is she talking about?" But when you were saying Gandhi was asking himself these questions, I think it's really important to know what your questions are.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned earlier this film, Fierce Grace, that Mickey Lemley made. He's made a couple of films. He's made one, Compassion in Exile, about the Dalai Lama, and Hasten Slowly, about Lawrence Vanderpost. And one time I watched Mickey be asked by somebody, what would you say is in common in the men that you've made these films about? And he said, well, I'm not sure. And I was sitting there going, oh, I know. Because these were all men who, no matter what the situation was and how seemingly powerless their position was, I mean, Lawrence Vanderpost was in a Japanese prisoner of war camp, their first question would be always, what is my responsibility? What response am I to make here? In situations where many of us would have said, well, you know, I'm helpless here. I can't do anything. And every time, and sometimes that was reduced to simply being a conscious witness of some injustice that was being done. But that was a very conscious choice to do that. So, you know, that kind of innate sense of I am always a participant and how I do what I do ripples out from me. So what is my responsibility here? And it's not always to act. I mean, sometimes that's just not available to us. And yet there's always some kind of internal response, holding a certain place that we can make. And it really does ripple out from us.
Yeah. Also a nice quote, we do not trust what we are. An echo of the beloved whom we secretly fear searches for everyone except us.
Mm. It's so much easier to believe that whatever the divine life force is, everything is made of that except us. That I'm some sort of strange exception to this, you know. If we really trusted that, and I think many of us have had experiences of it, you know, here and there in our lives, of that moment of that sense of incredible stillness and vastness that we are both part of and made of. But we don't trust that it's really the very fiber of the stuff we're made of, and that it's always there. I think of prayer now, not so much as my calling out to what has removed itself from me. You know, my sense is that that presence is always there. I pray to try and wake up, to bring to my consciousness then awareness of that presence. It didn't go anywhere in between my prayers. I just went a little bit to sleep.
Yeah, I love Rumi's quote, "The mystery does not get clearer by repeating the question."
Which for those of us who are, you know, big questioners, that's always sort of a discouraging line. And then that, and the rest of that is, nor is it bought by going to amazing places.
Yeah.
You know, I think of all the money and time and energy spent on sacred journeys to various places, wonderful adventures, and I'm not arguing against never doing that, but often they're driven by this hope that there will be an answer in those places that we cannot find at home. You know, that John Kabat-Zinn's book about the title is "Wherever You Go, There You Are."
Yep.
That's the catch with that one, you know. There you are, the same person, asleep or awake, in an amazing place.
Anything you'd like to add as we're closing?
I think, you know, the essence of the call is a sense also of worthiness. I think that many of us struggle with whether or not we feel that we're worthy to be called. And in fact, the reality is that the essence of who we are, by virtue of being born, we are called. We are called to learn how to be fully human beings, not to just be two-legged walking asleep, but to be fully human beings, and that we're all worthy of that and responding to it.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Again, this has been Bella Johnson, Alternative Current, speaking with Oriah Mountain Dreamer, author of The Call, published by Harper San Francisco, available anywhere. Talk to you next month.
One and two and three.